Welcome back to Teaching Matters, the University of Edinburgh's hub for discussing, promoting, and showcasing teaching and learning across the university. We're a website, blog, podcast, and most importantly, a small group of people passionate about providing platforms for conversations surrounding teaching and learning. I'm Sylvia, second-year PhD student and an intern at Teaching Matters, and I'll be walking you through this presentation. Get ready to listen to the first episode of our amazing podcast series on generative AI. In this series, we bring together conversations by an amazing group of guests from the Science, Technology and Innovations Department at the University of Edinburgh. We have an amazing group of staff and students coming together to discuss and share their perspectives on generative AI. We have Dr. Vasilis Galanas, a teaching fellow, Dr. James Stewart, a lecturer, Lara Dalmolin, a second-year PhD student, and Irene Chi, a master's student. I'll let Vasilis Galanas introduce himself.
Hi, my name is Vasilis Galanas. I am a teaching fellow at the Science, Technology and Innovation Studies Department at the University of Edinburgh, and I am interested in the interaction between expectations and expertise in artificial intelligence. I'm looking at issues of education as impacted by artificial intelligence, and I am also looking into policy dimensions of AI, robotics, and the vast landscape of digital technologies.
In this episode, Vasilis paints a wider picture, sharing interesting insights into word origins, history of generative AI, the present state of GPTs, and what future holds for this technology in academia. We have Lara and Irene asking questions to Vasilis in a roundtable format.
So maybe we could start with a few questions to Vasilis so we can all find out what are these technologies that we really are talking about today. So Vasilis, if I can ask you a few questions, I was wondering if you could tell us more about what distinguishes generative AI and GPTs in particular from previously existing AI technologies, and why is there so much hype?
Well, thank you very much, Lara, for the question. Thanks everyone for having me here. So this is a very hard question to answer precisely because AI is very loosely defined. AI has been around for a long time, for more than 70 years as a term. And essentially every time AI as a field achieves something, we forget everything about its previous achievements. So the hype kind of reemerges. So this is very interesting. Now, we used to program computers based on symbols and commands and everything. So with something like what is called rule-based logic. The difference after roughly 2010, very roughly, is that now we have lots of data. And that happened because we use the internet a lot. And that gives us the main source for training certain algorithms to learn from examples. And that's what gave rise to what we call the generative pre-trained transformers. That's what distinguishes previous rounds of AI with the current one. So generative means it creates something new. It's pre-trained. That means it's trained according to certain types of rules, certain desirable, certain deliverable goals. And it's a transformer. That means that it transforms the existing content into something statistically new. So for example, when it comes to text, it takes all existing texts about a given topic it can find, and then it transforms it into something that looks like the previous examples, but it's not the same statistically. So that becomes quite important in the context of plagiarism, for example, detection of text. Since the topic today is education, you cannot really prove that this has been plagiarized or something. So there are interesting questions there. Another difference, I would say, is speed. So for example, if you could paraphrase in the past, you know, nothing prevented a student from, you know, taking 10 books, 10 articles, read about a topic, paraphrase certain phrases, certain wording, certain sentences, and submit the coursework to a marker. But that process would be tedious. It would take, say, roughly 3 hours at the very best. So we hoped as educators that by this token, the student would learn the content of what they would be paraphrasing. But if the machine is able to paraphrase just based on statistics, and then the text looks quite original, then and also not detectable by other machines, then the problem is there. I would say another difference is the design, although that's contestable. So I would say that commercially existing GPTs that are quite popular in the broader domain are designed in a very, I would say, attractive way. They are designed in order to, based on all the rules that we know from the attention economy and so on, to attract people in, to lure them into using them more and more and more. And I would say that the sort of chat box kind of design they have, it's an interesting form of anthropomorphization. It's very human-like, so it feels as if you're really talking to a human, but that kind of gives a sort of familiarity, this sort of intimate feeling into their use. So a combination of all these aspects, although if you treat them separately, they're not really new. They have been there. This intimacy with machines has been around for a long, long time. The speed, well, I mean, we had fast AIs in a while, and the techniques themselves, the machine learning, the GPTs have been around for a while. But if you take the cumulative effect of all these, then this is what distinguishes GPTs from previous AI technologies.
Well, thank you for your wonderful explanation for the first question. And what are the effects and implications of hype for the use of this technology?
Thank you very much, Irene, for this question. So hype is another interesting word, pretty much like AI. Everyone talks about hype. One thing we need to remember is that hype comes from a Greek word that reads as hyperbole. That means exaggeration. So remember that hype is an exaggeration of certain characteristics of a given technology, for example, technological hype. So that is a double-edged sword. Sometimes it acts as a motivation to use something, as a motivation to improve, but it also comes up with lots of obscurations of problems that might be associated with the use of a given technology. So One huge impact of GPT-related hype, I would say, is over-reliance on the machine. Indeed, if you start using it, the initial impression, it stands out. It stands out very quickly. So, for example, so you have a query at the moment and you ask the machine, then you get a very nice polished answer. And then you think, well, maybe I can do a bit more. Maybe I can try a bit more and write an entire essay using that. Then you begin thinking about overinvestment, both in mental way, but also in a financial way. You think that this is a good tool that we could actually embed in our everyday structures and infrastructures within our word processors, within our browsers, and therefore we can have a reliable tool. So we build up our expectations around it without looking at specific problems that might be associated with it. So like I said, the text itself is generated in a transformative way. That means there's no human checking the problems themselves, right? So when it comes to, for example, social science, where you have fine nuances between argumentations, you might want to check what is being said, right? So it, in other cases, it might hinder creativity. So if you want to have your own, as we say in social science, authorial voice, you know, that's the key, that's a defining moment when your supervisor in a PhD or even a master's program kind of sees that you have found your own way for doing things, this kind of creativity might be hindered. So it's like an extension of what we used to call the Google effect, that we kind of forget how to search, what it means to search. So it automates certain processes. Yeah. And I would say, I would also add that overusing it also involves lots of environmental impact, although we might touch on that a bit later, but both training and using it is associated with lots of environmental impact, and usually hype invites people to try something a lot, to sometimes, you know, be there 10 hours a day just testing. So that might come with a huge environmental cost, which is not too much when you treat it at an individual person's level. But the, again, the cumulative effect of bigger, say, academic populations or business populations trying, testing these programs are quite significant.
Yeah, that sounds really good. Okay, so in light of everything that we've talked about so far, I was wondering if, Vasilis, you could kind of clarify what actually is a GPT and what are the current uses of this technology apart from literally generating text, where can we see this technology?
So in very layperson's terms, we can think of it as a combination of models and algorithms that essentially make use of existing data, as said previously, and they produce a new version of existing material. So in this sense, it makes lots of sense that it's particularly good in producing texts that we have many, many examples of. So a use case, I admit my guilt on that, I used it recently for, is to write a very boring letter to the taxation office, and it was very good. It was excellent. It would take me maybe an hour and a half to compose it myself, and I just had a perfect letter that I just changed the important bits and pieces. So it's particularly important. Now, in the education domain, I haven't really used it myself, just testing a bit to show to my students. But then I asked students to actually use it in class, to use it in their essays, but also report on how they used it and what were their difficulties in sort of polishing and so on. So apparently what my students told me is that it's particularly good in terms of polishing some text. So if, for example, English is not your first language, you know, you might be tempted, instead of paying somebody to do the proofreading, virtually you pay an array of other people who optimize the algorithm around the world, for different kind of salaries, to make a good model that you can use and you can polish your text. An anecdote from one of these student assessments I received, one student in particular said, I wanted to read a bit more academically. So there's this sort of method of enrichment of a person's vocabulary. So according to these models, you know, the way they are pre-trained, they have different degrees of fine-tuning, and therefore you can play with the complexity of the vocabulary. So use some more rare words, use some more accessible words. And again, that's all ancient information theory and statistics put in practice. So it's very good in producing forms. A huge application, a huge use case is Python code as well. So it's very good in producing Python code. So for people who deal a lot with computing, that poses an important problem. And I'm sure that if you interview some computer scientists, there might be very opposing views on the topic. Some people might be, yeah, that's great, that's fantastic. Some other will be like, yeah, but people will forget how to actually code. So it's an interesting thing. Somewhere on the intersection between social scientists and computer scientists, I think it's particularly good in interpreting statistical results. So if you give it a graph, and you're too lazy to write down the interpretation of it, and you want to use this very dry language that some statisticians are using in order to interpret a graph, well, the machine can do it for you. Now, like I said before, we need to be very, very careful with these things, because in statistics, it's extremely easy to extrapolate from a given graph and say that a meaning is such and such, whereas a more careful interpretation would include certain parameters, hidden variables, or whatever. So that's what makes the difference in a good interpretation in statistics. So context is extremely important. In this case, that's what has been true about AI for a long, long time, that machines are particularly incompetent in understanding context, a social context, you know, desires, the social background of things. And if we are tasked with something and we use a machine assistant in something, then we need to look at these details. So these are some use cases I have been able to think.
Thank you so much. That's wonderful. I feel like through this, we've kind of covered a little bit of the history of these models almost. So I think one last question that I wanted to ask you was, how can we expect these technologies to develop and evolve in the future? Where can we see this going?
Well, history is teaching us how unpredictable the technological trajectories are and can be. So I would be very cautious in predicting the future. I think we should be ready for various political games being played across all the different nodes on the value chain that or network, to speak more realistically, and all the geopolitics that are involved in the access to data and training model industries and so on. I would say we could expect certain labor shifts. That's what history has taught us around AI. So this age-old fascination about creating a robotic helper, an assistant of sorts, an android, an automaton in different ages had different names from the ancient times up until the Middle Ages and today. So we think that we're too lazy of doing stuff. Well, maybe we can automate it. We can create a machine. What AI history has taught us is that the labor shifts not from the user to the machine per se, but from the user to an array of workers around the world that enable the existence of this machine. So with ICTs, there's this sort of reskilling type of process. So indeed, very few jobs might be considered a bit obscured and outdated, but then there's a new market for many other jobs. Now, to what extent we actually want that? That's a deeper educational philosophical question or political question. But I would say that it's certainly a player at the moment. The emergence of GPT is itself a player that we should consider, but we also have the power to have more of these conversations like the present one and to be able to steer the conversation towards what we want from our working environments. And there is time, I think, to shift the process. So, for example, in terms of unpredictability, when in the early 2000s the internet was relatively new for many people, it became more and more popularized. I got my first computer in 2005, for example. I got my first smartphone, I think, in 2012. No, it was later, it was 2014. So this kind of feeling that you share your data with people, it appeared to be very liberatory, very sort of radical, and so on. Who would have told us that this would create the foundation for language models in the future, that massive corporations would use these and the political ramifications, for example, platforms that were based on the idea of freedom of speech would eventually embargo access to their data in light of the present trajectory. So expect the unexpected. And that's, I guess, my closing line for this one. And thank you very much.
That's wonderful. And I think that one of the most interesting questions that you posed in there was, do we actually want this? And how do we actually want this? And maybe that's something that we can explore through the next sections as well.
Stay tuned to Teaching Matters to listen to the next episode of this podcast series that features a conversation between Vasilis Gelanis and Irene Chi, a master's student, giving a student perspective on the usage of AI in her day-to-day coursework. Teaching Matters is brought to you by the University of Edinburgh's Institute of Academic Development. For more posts and conversations about teaching and learning, head to our blog. We'd be delighted for you to join these conversations. Do so, just email us, teachingmatters@ed.ac.uk. You can also find us on Twitter. If you enjoyed this episode, please consider following us on Spotify or subscribing on Apple Podcasts and leaving a 5-star review. Music for this episode was provided by Hook Sounds. In the meantime, stay curious.